This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is the poet Frank X. Walker. I've been dying to talk to him once I was told he was coming to town, and once I was able to get my feet into a couple of his books, which were hard to find, actually. He teaches at the University of Kentucky. He's the founding member of the Afrolation Poets, and that is a word that he coined himself, Afrolation. He's the editor of America, What's My Name? The Other Poets Unfurl the Flag. And he's the author of several fascinating books of poetry, including Afrolasia, Isaac Murphy, Buffalo Dance, and the new and fantastic Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evers. Frank X. Walker, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your background, where you grew up, how you got interested in poetry.
Well, I'm a Kentucky boy. Grew up in central Kentucky. It's hard to accept the idea that I'm a poet, although most people know me as the poet. You know, I'm more comfortable with failed fiction writer. You know, that novel hasn't happened yet.
And that's been a long time dream?
It's been a long time dream. I actually finished it, my first and second draft of that novel this summer. So it's closer to reality than ever. You know, but I always say I'm a writer by accident. You know, I had a childhood accident that kept me in the house and in the sling for a number of years.
What happened? Four.
Well, you're old enough to remember the old washing machines with the barrel and the double cylinders on the top that you wring the clothes out. Well, my arm got caught in there accidentally. And to make it short, so it's pretty gruesome. But during the recovery time, my mother brought me lots of books and magazines. And there was something about my recuperation and healing that became connected to learning to read. So it was always books always had kind of a magical power for me growing up. So I fell in love with books very early. And I think as a consequence of loving books and then loving words and pages and the smell of books and everything about books, it was only natural for me to want to be a writer. But going in off to college out of high school, I didn't know any writers of color. My counselors insisted I should be an engineer. I had the academic background for it, but I didn't have the interest. So
counselors have misdirected generations of people.
Yes, and they still do so. So it took me going to college and not enjoying myself and going back home and getting a job in a factory and figuring out that the factory work was worse than college. So I went back to college and changed my major and eventually ended up in an English class with the great fiction writer Gurney Norman. And, you know, the cliche, the rest is history. You know, I really figured out my path at that point.
Was there a particular book? I mean, obviously there was a particular teacher who did it, but was there a novel or a writer or a book of poetry that really turned you on?
Well, not really, because I already had the passion in high school, and I was already in love with books. I mean, I started out, and there was a section of the library where I tried to read the whole shelf, you know. So, you know, I went through Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, and then I graduated to Sherlock Holmes and read everything by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and I felt good about that. So I knew that, you know, the passion, the fire was already there. Just making that connection, you know, I remember being published in high school, and for the first time, my peers saw me differently. You know, I kind of had this split personality. When I wore my glasses, I was the nerd. When I was on the football field, I was the jock.
And what positions did you play?
I was all the speed positions. Never left the field. Flanker back, free safety. You know, the sprint man on the kickoff team and punt teams. But the thing about it is that people thought that I had a twin brother, because that nerd could not have been that jock, because they don't compute.
They rarely inhabit the same body.
Rarely. But both of those were me. But we had a literary magazine, and I had written this poem about, it's kind of a brutal poem about the assistant principal. And my peers loved it. And there was something about the attention that I got from their appreciation of this poem that expressed their own feelings that kind of alerted me that there was something else.
Did you get in trouble for that poem?
Well, I got some frowns from the vice principal, but the folks on the bus had more power. and I wanted to feel that again. And I had one chance to take a creative writing 9-week course in high school, and it just wasn't long enough. And it wasn't until Gurney Norman's class about probably 4 years later that it really made sense, because before that, the opportunity to do it as a career or do it full-time, not that I do that now, but even then, it wasn't reality. But Norman made it seem real for me. I mean, he's the first person to tell me that I could write and I was a writer. And I tried it on and it fit, and I enjoyed it. And I wanted to prove him right. So I'm still trying to prove him right.
Oh, I think you have proven him right. The poet on the show today is Frank X. Walker. He teaches at the University of Kentucky. His books of poetry include Afrolacia, Isaac Murphy, Buffalo Dance, and a new and tremendous book called Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evers. All these titles are political. You are drawing attention to racism, to slavery, to discrimination, to injustice, and you're using poetry as that vehicle. For a long time, when I was studying poetry in high school or college, that was frowned upon. I mean, you know, there's no such thing as a good political poem, we were told by the snobby T.S. Eliot folks.
True. You know, I don't believe that. I think that, I think initially, I didn't think I was being political, but I think all poems are political. I know that my love of history was really the driving force behind taking on the first historical poetry project that dealt with Lewis and Clark, because of what the story represented to me. You know, this was a chance to retell the Lewis and Clark expedition in a way that I'd never heard before. Most people think about Lewis and Clark, two white superheroes, and not 42 people who were along, you know, not a Native American 15-year-old with a 3-month-old baby, and definitely not an African-American manservant who was responsible for saving their lives at least twice during the expedition. I'd never heard of this guy, and he'd lived in Kentucky, and I was embarrassed by that. So I tried to do the research, and once I figured out there was enough story there to write a little bit about it, I started sharing the story, and then I couldn't stop. And the Buffalo Dance came out of that project to retell the story from York's point of view, and to do it in a way that didn't skip over some things like the contribution of Native Americans and the kind of opening up in the beginning of the end of the West. I mean, it was that manifest destiny means a different thing on reservations. That's when it became political.
It was a real interesting book because, first of all, I'd never heard of this guy either. We hear about Lewis and Clark, we hear about Sacagawea, but we don't hear about York, and we don't get a sense, what was Lewis like as a boss? What was Clark like as a boss? And evidently they weren't the greatest bosses in the world. So that was a whole nother subtext, but a really interesting book. Is there a poem in here, short poem you want to read that you read sometimes, or should we just push along here?
Well, we probably should push along because it would take as long to put it in context as to read it.
But I do recommend this to anybody. It's called Buffalo Dance, The Journey of York. York is the African-American assistant to Lewis and Clark. It's a part of our own history that we don't hear about. But this technique you use, and this is kind of an archaeological technique or a historian's technique. You go in there with your toothbrush and your shovel and you dust off everything and find these people don't know about. I mean, the other book that was like this is Isaac Murphy. I dedicate this ride. Isaac Murphy, tell us about him.
Well, Isaac is another one of those stories. You know, people talk about, in Kentucky, the most famous African-American athlete is probably Muhammad Ali from Kentucky. But Isaac Murphy was first, was probably even more successful. He's still the winningest jockey in horse racing. He won 44% of every race he ever entered. So if you consider first, second, and third, he probably made a lot of people rich, because he didn't bet on himself, or he didn't even bet at all. When I started doing the research, I was amazed at how much of the articles were about his character and his nobleness. And
he didn't whip the horses.
He didn't whip the horses, and that, you know, that kind of forced the issue of the first poem in the book. You know, he said he just talked to him. So, you know, my question was, well, what the hell did you say to make him go so fast and to earn their cooperation and respect? So I tried to create a character in a book that tried to explain his story and also explain what happened with horse racing. When you consider that the first Kentucky Derby, the majority of the jockeys were African American. And in one generation, they almost disappeared. And that wasn't by accident. You know, when you do the research, you see that what happened during post-Reconstruction in Kentucky and the return of horse-connected cavalry Confederate individuals who chased African Americans out of horse racing, except for those you know, low positions like groomsmen and hot walkers. But most of the jockeys, you know, left the United States and raced in Europe. A few of them hung around, but it only took a single generation to get African Americans who dominated, you know, that industry in the beginning.
And that's a part of U.S. sports history that I never heard about until 2 or 3 years ago, reading Dave Zirin's A People's History of Sports in the United States. Zirin writes for The Nation and The Progressive, and he's on radio, he's on TV, he's on MSNBC with Rachel Maddow. I'm going to send him this book called Isaac Murphy, I Dedicate This Ride, by my guest today, Frank Walker. Do you want to read a poem from there, either that first one that you talked about or another one in here?
Sure. I'll just read the first one. And this book opens with Isaac on the back of a horse trying to explain how he convinces the horses to run so fast. And I had asked myself the question, what did he say? And this is his response, Murphy's secret in the voice of Isaac Murphy. When folks find out I'm him, they always want to know what I say to them. If they be white, I tell them, I say, run and run quick, or they gonna feed you to the niggas. And they usually laugh and leave me be. But if they be black, I tell them the truth. I tell them how I cut my hand to a horse's ear, how I let it catch some wind so they remember what it sound like to run full out, to know you not just a field hand or a workhorse, but beautiful and strong and smart. I don't never have to ask them to honor something you can't really see, just feel. I just nudge them like the exhausted mamas do soon as they are born and licked dry, until they unfold them wobbly legs and stand. When I'm up there, I rub my hands against their neck, lean into their ear, pretend I'm the wind, and whisper, find your purpose, find your purpose, and hold on.
That's beautiful. That's Frank Walker reading Murphy's Secret from his book, Isaac Murphy, I Dedicate This Ride. This is a book, as we've been talking about the history of black Kentucky jockeys and how they dominated the sport until they were run out of the sport. Tell me a little bit about this latest work that is not published yet, but it's coming out in a couple months, Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evers.
Well, you know, it comes, I guess, from the same space when you consider the motivation. You know, I'm really attracted to stories that are either, they seem muted or left out or undertowed. And I started asking my students, you know, what they knew about the civil rights era, and particularly assassinations. And almost all of them, to a person, remembered Malcolm, King, and the Kennedy brothers, and a few, Fred Hampton, but none of them mentioned Medgar Evers. And that struck me, and I started doing some kind of flipping through a historical text, and a lot of textbooks had left him out, that they started the civil rights era in 65.
I mean, it's amazing how people can just disappear, isn't it?
And it's embarrassing to me when you realize that we're cheating our children if they don't know this information.
You have a poem in the voice of his widow saying if you think the civil rights movement just started in 64, you are doing a disservice to all those other people who were working in the civil rights movement.
Absolutely. I mean, there are so many people whose names we don't know, and to take somebody whose name is so important and have him disappear seems an injustice to me.
Who is Medgar Evers?
Well, Medgar Evers was a NAACP worker who really, you know, this is an interesting time to talk about him because his sole purpose, his major energy was spent in trying to get people registered to vote in Mississippi. He worked out of Jackson, Mississippi. And, you know, he became a villain to white supremacist ideologists and ideas because he just wanted blacks to be registered to vote and participate in the political process. And that made him this enemy worth killing. And he was assassinated in his own driveway with his wife and kids inside the house. And, you know, he was a young man still. But, you know, they weren't surprised it was going to happen. They knew the work they were doing was dangerous because they knew Mississippi. And, you know, a lot of my work requires me to go and do site-specific research. And I spent time in Jackson, Mississippi and other parts of Mississippi.
What was that like?
Well, it was, you know, I think that in Kentucky, I always think I'm in the north until I go north, and I'm in the south until I go south. But it was uncomfortable for me, unless there was food on the table. Then I felt at home when there was food on the table and there's a sweet tea in my hand. The landscape is beautiful and eerie at the same time. There's something about, you know, miles of cotton fields that just kind of bring up not really pleasant images and ideas for me. But being that close to the truth made it easier to I think, put my thumb on the pulse of the story. And that's really important for me to, you know, because, you know, these poems are considered historical poetry, even though there's no official category for that. There's historical fiction, but you can't go to the bookstore and ask for the historical poetry section. But it's the same thing, just in poetic verse. But it's more emotional, and it takes poetic license because the poet has to make up the conversation, but it still has to be authentic and respect what happened historically. So the historical facts have you locked in, but, you know, there's a poem here about the voice, what happened in the voice of the bullet. We know bullets can't speak, but that was a way to tell the story using details from the court transcripts that really kind of sum up that one part of the story in a way that, you know, doesn't slow down the telling.
You also use the voice or inhabit or imagine the voice of the killer, of Byron de la Beckwith. That must have been hard.
It's the hardest voice I've ever tried on. And what was even harder was doing the research, you know. Unfortunately, at the same time, all I had to do was to go on YouTube and just put in racist song or racist chant. And there was so much information and so many images that are not 50 years old, like this story is, that are happening right now, that it would just creep me out. But I was able to pull together an authentic sound and voice that I think that does justice to what Beck was stood for. And it doesn't explain his hatred, but it provides some logic. If you try to understand, how do you get from this victrolic hatred to violence? And to do it in a justifiable way and be unrepentant like he was when he finally went to his death at the end of his life. But it's a very important story, and I'm really proud of this book, and I'm looking forward to having those conversations that will happen because it exists.
It took him forever to get a conviction, though.
It took three trials, and the first two were laughable because, like many trials in the South, that, you know, in that part of the country, in that time period, you know, people knew the outcome before it even started. But, you know, I think that I'm glad that it happened in the way that it did, because I think, you know, for us, even with, you know, President Obama's reelection, race is still a difficult topic in America. It's still the elephant in the room. It's still the hardest thing to talk about in most spaces. And I hope that, you know, this book, if nothing else, it could be a blueprint to have a conversation about how to get past that, or at least how to approach that direction, because I think we're a long way from solving it. But
I mean, isn't it surprising you how palpable that racism still is? There was a rally for Romney a week before Obama got reelected, and someone was wearing a button, "Vote Romney, it's the white thing to do." and then there are the nastier things with, you know, Obama being hanged in effigy and
right,
things along that line. But just, you know, for someone to be so brazen as to wear a button like that, it's pretty astonishing.
Well, it is. It doesn't surprise me. What it does is embarrass me. But the truth is, I think that we have to, I think as a whole, we have to stop giving it so much power. You know, for example, recently, at the University of Mississippi, at about midnight after the election this year, a gathering that was reported as a riot happened on campus. And in truth, it was 35 students who were angry about the results. And then 200 people came outside to see what was happening. And that was reported widely. And so now University of Mississippi has that black eye. But what wasn't reported was the very next day, the campus organized a candlelight vigil that drew thousands of people protesting that image of the university, and that had all the faculty, the administrators, 10 times as many students. So for the minority voice to get that much power and to misrepresent an entire institution is unfortunate, but there's something about bad news that just travels so fast. You know, that's the old cliche.
It's out there, though. I mean, but the hopeful thing coming out of the election on, well, first of all, we've elected an African-American president twice
again.
Now. I never thought it was going to happen in my lifetime. And he hasn't been assassinated. I mean, that was a fear that I had, and I know lots and lots of people had. I'm sure you may have had that fear.
I think many people did, but and we have no idea how many death threats he gets every day. Hmm. And, you know, from my understanding, it's a ridiculous number. The amount of hate mail, and I mean, if you read, there's an article that came out. Well, my local paper printed an editorial that kind of spoke towards, you know, a new day. And, you know, Kentucky's a red state. But then if you read the comments from the readers that come afterwards, it shows you that there are still those people who have not gotten past it, who refuse to accept the reality. And I don't know what you could do with those folks. I think there are people who will go to their graves with that attitude. They're just that angry. And they disagree so strongly about that kind of change.
But they're being left behind, I think. The younger generation of people are so much more open-minded. They're leaving this baggage behind, finally, thank God.
Yeah, I think the national election results say that very loudly. You know, the number of women and the causes, the marriage amendments. I mean, I think all those things collectively say the exact opposite thing that Mitch McConnell was saying.
I'm speaking with Frank Walker. He's a poet who teaches at the University of Kentucky. He's the publisher of several, author of several great books of poetry, including one called Isaac Murphy about black jockeys in the late 19th century who were dominating the sport and tremendous athletes and then were booted out of the sport, and a book called Buffalo Dance, The Journey of York, about an African-American servant for Lewis and Clark, who did heroic duty even though he was mistreated by Clark and Lewis. And he's got this great new book we've been talking about a little bit called Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evers. I was privileged to be able to talk to Merle Evers once and interview her on this radio program. And what a heroic person she is, and what a strong and wonderful and beautiful person.
Oh, absolutely. The entire family, to you know, they, you know, work tirelessly to keep Mega's, you know, story and legacy alive. And I'm fortunate enough to have been invited to next year's national celebrations or commemoration of his passing. It'll be 50 years in 2013. So in June, I think June 12th in Jackson, Mississippi, I have a chance to be there to meet them in person and to read from the book.
Here's one poem. Why don't you read a poem that you'd like? There's one poem there are a lot of poems in here I'd like you to read. Here's one you could read, When Death Moved In. If there's another favorite you'd rather read, read that. I just want the listener in her office or his car or their kitchen to be able to get a sense of your voice and your work when you're writing verse.
Sure. This is a poem called When Death Moved In, in the voice of Merle Evers. When death moved in, it attached itself to our lives first like an unplanned pregnancy, then like our fourth child. We didn't talk about its disfigured face or its crooked limbs and spine. We went about the people's business, tried to pretend that it wasn't really there, though some nights it filled every open space in the room, often crawling into bed between us, making it difficult to sleep. Every new registered voter, successful boycott, demonstrations, and primetime television minute put fat on its face. Images of Medgar escorting James Meredith into Old Miss were celebrated with new front teeth. When it crawled to the front door and spoke its first cuss words, it sounded like a car backfired twice.
It's amazing how someone like Merle Evers would, or anybody whose loved one has been shot down, can finally move on or incorporate that into their lives and still not be overcome not only with sadness but with rage.
Well, she talks about it in her autobiographies that it made her angry and that, you know, she really was, you know, she had a lot of hatred in response to his assassination, but that, you know, she realized that she was focusing on what was taken from her. And then years later, she realized that that Megger had been the family activist, and his loss made her stronger. And she was now the guardian of the family and the children and his legacy. And so she became this new person. She went back and finished her life and became, she probably could have never become who she became if he had lived, because she was comfortable just being in the background, let him be the, you know, the star.
I'm speaking with Frank Walker. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Part of this book that I found so gripping, Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evers, doesn't have to do with Medgar Evers anymore, but has to do with this lingering romanticization of the South, of Dixie, of the pre-Civil War South. What is that about? What do you make of all that? And you write poems about that in this book, which is one of the reasons I wanted to ask you about it. If you want to answer with a poem or if you want to answer any way you want. It's just, you know, it amazes me to still see Confederate flags in, even in Wisconsin. But, you know, I went down to Gulf Shores, Alabama, and boy, there were Confederate flags all over the place down there.
Well, you know, that's true and unfortunate. I think I will try to answer that with a poem, because I think the reality is, because of people's refusal to accept anything like change, there are two Mississippis. And this is called One Mississippi, Two Mississippis. You got old plantations, we got shotgun houses. You got sprawling verandas, we got a piece of front porch. You got beautiful gardens, we got cotton fields. You got Old Miss Law School, we got parchment prison. You got Gulf Shore beaches, we got riverbanks. You got debutante balls, we got juke joints. You got bridge parties, we got dominoes and spades. You got mint juleps, we got homemade hooch. You got your grandmother's china, we got paper plates. You see a proud history, we see a racist past. You don't remember lynchings, we can't forget. You got blacks, we got the blues.
That's Frank Walker reading a poem from his latest book that's going to be out soon. It's called Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evers. You can go to his website at frankxwalker.com. Frank Walker, it's been a pleasure to meet you and to hear your poetry and to let our listeners hear this poetry. Very important stories that you tell, voices that you uncover, and your own beautiful voice, too. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for what you do here.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.